Welcome to KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's October 17th of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, Rocky Mountain Community Radio takes us to the Four Corners region to meet a Navajo seed keeper preserving and sharing ancestral foods online. And CityCast Denver looks at how History Colorado is preparing to retell the story of the Sand Creek Massacre after fumbling it a decade ago. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the BBC News headlines and then the Hightower Lowdown. After that, it's Good Ol' CU with Joe Yuhas. Then at 9 a.m., we'll bring you Counterspin, a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. After that, Carrie Wolfson will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first, these headlines with KGNU's Claire Purnell.
Election ballots are being mailed to active voters in Colorado today. Matt Crane, the executive director of the Colorado County Clerks Association, says that voters should understand it may take several days for the ballots to be delivered.
A lot of voters tend to get nervous if they don't receive their ballots the next day. The way the post office delivers ballots here in Colorado, they go out in waves. Even though the ballots may drop from a county on Monday, it could take a full week for a voter to get their ballot.
Crane says if people don't receive their ballot by Monday, October 24th, they should call their clerk and recorder to have a replacement ballot mailed, or they can go in person to a voter service and polling center to get a replacement ballot or vote in person. With the midterm election less than a month away, some counties are reporting difficulties in recruiting election staff this year. Regina O'Brien, clerk and recorder for Eagle County, said her district is actually seeing a resurgence of people interested in getting involved.
I've also had engagement from folks who've had questions, and that's always one of the things when voters have questions, I'll spend as much time as I can explaining the processes like all clerks do, but then I invite them. If you'd like to serve as a judge, come be a part of the process.
Matt Crane also encourages voters to engage directly with their local clerk and recorder's office as a way to counteract the misinformation around the elections.
Come learn the truth from the experts. Don't listen to the lies from the grifters.
Crane encourages voters to sign up to track their mail-in ballot. That can be done through the official state website colorado.ballottracks.net. Governor Jared Polis and Republican challenger Heidi Gnall faced each other Sunday evening in the third gubernatorial candidate debate. The event, which took place in Colorado Springs, saw both candidates disagreeing on topics like energy and public safety. Gnall, a CU regent, accused Polis of decimating oil and gas and vowed to get the industry back to work.
Let's produce oil and gas here, put people back to work, and make sure those dollars get back into the schools where they help our kids learn how to read.
Governor Polis reiterated his commitment to get the state to 100% renewable energy by 2040, saying our reliance on fossil fuels makes the state vulnerable, citing the 2021 snowstorm in Texas that led to a major power outage. Polis also said switching to renewable energy is cost-effective.
We need low-cost, renewable energy, energy independence, reliable, in Colorado to be able to save people money and make Colorado more competitive.
Gnall mentioned the fentanyl crisis numerous times during the debate, accusing Governor Polis of being soft on crime when it comes to the drug, something Polis denied, saying the sale of fentanyl remains a felony in the state.
We're second highest in fentanyl increase in deaths in the country. You think you're doing a good job with fentanyl?
This is a national plague. We're 26th, to be clear, in fentanyl deaths.
No, we are second highest in the increase in
fentanyl deaths. Last time you said that, it was corrected on television by a fact checker who said we were 26th. I mean, you can say whatever you want, but the truth matters.
In one of the more heated moments of the debate, Polis and Gnall sparred over COVID vaccines, stemming from a question on a woman's right to choose in the context of abortion.
But also, if you care so much about women's healthcare choices, how come you fired so many women healthcare workers because they didn't feel comfortable getting a vaccination during COVID?
Governor, you choose to respond?
Well, look, Colorado remains a state where, you know, we have friends that haven't been vaccinated and friends who have. I certainly encourage it. I've been vaccinated.
Did they lose their job by you?
The Omicron.
Did you fire them?
No, state workers, they had to, there was a period of time during the midst of the pandemic where they either got tested or they had the vaccine.
You either believe in women's healthcare choices or not.
Well, I am opposed, and I have been opposed, and you know I have been, to vaccine requirements. I even negotiated.
Why didn't you put your foot down? You're in charge. You're the
because
governor.
Because it's not about rhetoric. It's about encouraging people to do the right thing. I bet there's people here who didn't get vaccinated.
Jared, I've met with many
vaccinated?
Women
no.
healthcare
have
workers.
Have you been vaccinated? Have you been vaccinated?
Yes, I have.
Okay, and thank you for agreeing with me that we shouldn't force others to get
That's
vaccinated.
That's my own personal decision.
Okay.
Polis and Ganahl are scheduled to debate again on October 25th in Grand Junction. A Colorado Springs woman is the latest inmate to die this year in the El Paso County Jail. The El Paso County Sheriff's Office identified the deceased woman as 58-year-old Felicia Hudson. She was found dead in her cell Friday night. Hudson had been booked into the county jail one day prior to her death. Police say the El Paso County Coroner's Office will conduct a full autopsy to make an official determination as to the cause of death. A media scan of other reported deaths in the same facility shows Hudson is at least the sixth person found dead this year inside of the El Paso County Jail. A mass shooting at a house party in Adams County left one dead and seven wounded. The shooting occurred at around 3 a.m. Saturday. The Adams County Sheriff's Office is seeking information about the driver of an early 2000s model blue Chevrolet Tahoe, filmed by a surveillance camera near the crime scene. The city of Boulder will close the Mount Sanitas Trail and parts of the Sanitas Valley and Dakota Ridge Trail on Tuesday for repairs. KGNU's Jack Armstrong has more.
The city of Boulder Open Space and Mountain Parks will use a helicopter to move materials necessary for Mount Sanitas Trail repairs. The helicopter will operate tomorrow from 6:30 a.m. until 5 p.m. The popular trail site will be closed to the public during repairs, and people who access the restricted areas may receive citations from rangers. This project is funded by Boulder Open Space Conservancy, whose mission is to advocate and enhance the ecological resilience of our public lands to climate change through sponsorship of conservation projects like this one. For KGNU, I'm Jack Armstrong.
This week is Winter Weather Preparedness Week. The National Weather Service is issuing a series of public information advisories urging Colorado residents to be informed about the hazards that winter can bring. Monday is Winter Travel Safety. Tuesday is winter watches, warnings, and advisories. Wednesday is high winds. Thursday is wind chill temperatures and hypothermia. And Friday is avalanche safety. Today, for winter travel safety, the Weather Service says to check forecast and road conditions, winterize your vehicle with winter tires, and pack emergency supply kits. Make sure your car has recently been serviced and check your tires for air pressure. For today's weather, it was frosty last night. But the sun is out this morning and we will have highs near 64 degrees. Expect calm winds from the southeast at around 5 miles per hour in the afternoon. Tonight will be clear with a low of around 39 and light and variable winds coming from the southwest at around 5 miles per hour. For KGNU, I'm Claire Purnell.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. A Navajo seed keeper is preserving and sharing the foods of his ancestors with customers online and over 13,000 followers on Twitter. It all started with the blue corn stalks that he grows on his farm in Shiprock, New Mexico. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, Clark Adamitis of KSUT and KSJD visited him to learn more.
Yeah, I've only seen two of these. Where the stalks like are entirely purple. This is like very rare.
In Shiprock, New Mexico, on a rainy day with slippery clay earth caking our boots, Graham Bial takes me on a tour of his 4-acre cornfield where he lives and works. The iconic mile-tall Shiprock is obscured by the clouds, but Bial's blue corn stalks are impressive, standing 12 feet high.
I was actually going to be picking today, but with the rain, I'm probably just going to wait for a while. So what we'll do is pick out on the field, and then over at the corner, kind of where you came in, there's like a drying rack. And so that's what we put all the corn on, and it just kind of sits there for a couple of days until it's fully dry. From that, then we'll take it off, taking the kernels off of the cob.
The corn stalks that Bial is growing have a legacy in the Navajo tradition. His blue corn was given to him by an elder and has been passed down for many generations. Bial works every day to preserve his ancestors' legacy by growing and sharing the crops.
One of my grandpas, I remember we were walking around and we went into the cornfield, and he goes in there and he picks a corn. He said, "You can grow a whole field from this, and this is like thousands of years in this corn, and now it's yours." So I have a couple of seeds, you know, been given to me by different elders, different mentors, and different people in the community.
He shows me a bunch of glass jars with colorful seeds in each one.
So yeah, this is some of the seeds, bean seeds to sugarcane seeds, watermelon seeds to oats, and then all different kinds of like corn. The main staple that I focus on is blue corn.
During the pandemic, he started selling his blue corn kernels online with a modest sales goal.
Kind of just started off. I have 12 jars of blue corn. Would anyone be interested in buying? The response from that was like phenomenal. Like within minutes, all of them were sold. So I was like, okay, there's a market there.
That was 3 years ago. Now he's selling more products online and connects with a bigger audience through over 13,000 Twitter followers. His posts often go viral when he shares native recipes.
It's not necessarily trying to be an influencer. I'm communicating to people in a vast, broad way. It kind of enables me to have a bigger voice.
Bial is part of a growing community of indigenous social media influencers. Dr. Elizabeth Hoover, a professor of Native American environmental health at UC Berkeley, says social media is an important connector for Native seed keepers.
Being able to see, like, oh, actually, there's people all over the country who are doing that, who are also growing these beautiful seeds, has been encouraging for people. Many of these seeds are incredibly beautiful, right? They're really colorful and they've got different patterns on them than a lot of conventional seed varieties you might pick up. These platforms lend themselves to kind of showcasing how beautiful these seeds are.
According to Hoover, cultural ancestry and community health go hand in hand with seed keeping.
If you want to eat healthy, you could just plant a bunch of kale or something that maybe you don't necessarily have a cultural connection to. I think people want to eat healthy, you know, for their physical health, but they also want to promote cultural health and spiritual health through having access to these foods.
According to the CDC, Native Americans have a greater chance of having type 2 diabetes than any other U.S. racial group. Bial says that the COVID-19 pandemic revealed some alarming health trends in Native communities.
With the pandemic, it really exposed a lot of deficiencies, and COVID really attacked people with underlying conditions. We as Native Americans struggle a lot.
Back under the tarp at Bial's farm with rain still coming down, he gazes out at his cornfield. Jars of colorful seeds sit on the table in front of him.
We fundamentally had a relationship with the fresh foods, the healthy foods, the seeds that we carried. And in a way, we've kind of detached ourselves from that.
But Bial has reconnected with these foods. He's excited to continue sharing his crops through harvest season and hopes to reach an even wider audience in his fourth year of seed keeping. For KSUT and KSJD, I'm Clark Adamitis.
Many adults in Colorado never learned about the Sand Creek Massacre in school. Thanks to a new exhibit opening next month at History Colorado, more people will learn the story about what happened on November 29, 1864, when soldiers, many of them newly arrived settlers in the Boulder County area, ambushed and killed hundreds of Cheyenne and Arapaho women, children, and elders. More than 150 years later, the painful remnants of this brutal mass murder are still fresh for many survivors' descendants. But they haven't always been treated respectfully by those in charge of commemorating our state's history. CityCast Denver host Bree Davies sits down with Westword editor Patricia Calhoun to talk about the story she broke about the last time History Colorado tried to open an exhibit dedicated to the Sand Creek Massacre in 2012, and the decade of soul-searching that led to the new one opening next month.
So, Patty, History Colorado is opening this new and long-awaited exhibit about the Sand Creek Massacre next month, but I wanted you to tell me about the Sand Creek exhibit that History Colorado opened 10 years ago.
So when History Colorado had its brand new building, you know, its new name, History Colorado, as opposed to Colorado Historical Society, and that beautiful building on Broadway designed by David Triba, and when it opened in April 2012, they had planned for a series of exhibits that would look into different cultures of Colorado, including, you know, there's one about Deerfield, which is a pretty interesting exhibit. Then they had some that were clearly designed just to Disneyfy the experience.
The tourism draw.
Right. You could jump in a mine, which was right next to a Ben's Fort exhibit that had some really bad caricatures of Native Americans. You could ride on a ski lift. So they had a variety of different activities that were supposed to bring you in. And then they had this Collision, which was an exhibit designed to talk about Sand Creek. And they did want to present it as a travesty. But unfortunately, they didn't consult with the tribes the way they are supposed to, really by congressional fiat. You are supposed to talk to the tribes. And they had all these sound effects, like you could hear Indians running as the troops were coming to massacre them. And as the tribes, the descendants of the Sand Creek Massacre, learned about it, they begged History Colorado not to open the, first to make changes, but then they begged them just not even to open it. And History Colorado went ahead and opened this exhibit that was supposed to commemorate the November 1864 massacre of 200 people, but really added insult to injury by not talking to their descendants and following the storyline they wanted. I mean, there were factual errors in the thing.
That's wild to me because this is like...
It's history.
It's history.
And I have to say the tribes, they really wanted to work behind the scenes and they started talking to me about it. And I wrote a story that following February after it had opened, after it hadn't closed. And within about 2 months, they did wind up closing the exhibit. So now, almost 10 years later, History Colorado has worked and worked and worked with the tribes. There's complete buy-in on this for this exhibit that'll open in November.
So I want to go back. So part of it was... A, they didn't talk to the tribes. B, it was called Collision, which you talk about in your story, but this inferred in some way that this was a battle when in reality it was like a slaughter.
A slaughter of a group of Native Americans. It was Arapaho and Cheyenne who were camped there under a flag, a white flag, because they thought they had the protection of the U.S. Army.
And then also it was within... The context of the museum itself seemed to lean more towards this Disneyfication, and it just didn't feel appropriate.
No, and you know they're trying to make, and certainly at the turn of this last century, museums desperate to get people in, especially history museums, trying to make it living history. So you have all these interactive components, and sometimes it's just not appropriate. And certainly in this case, to put you in the shoes of people who are fleeing troops that were bent on massacring them, and you hear these sounds, it really wasn't reverential, let's put it that way.
And you mentioned that the tribes, some folks had reached out to you about this issue. Can you talk about how you came to this story?
I've always been really interested in the Sand Creek Massacre, and part of it is the aftermath of it. So people didn't learn about this in class.
Certainly, I didn't.
And I can't remember when I first learned about it, but I started going to Sand Creek early on back in 2007 when the site was dedicated. Then I got really involved with the Sand Creek 150th Anniversary Commission and spent a lot of time talking to people, including then Governor Hickenlooper, about the problems at History Colorado. So some of the descendants had started talking to me for a story.
So the museum was aware that the tribes were not happy about this exhibit prior to the, because this is not just an exhibit opening, this is the museum is opening.
Right, so they're working on a lot of exhibits, but one of the things is they did talk to some of the descendants because they had to get some information, but 5 months, I know, before the museum opened, the descendants are really, you have to fix this. This is a problem, and they were ignored. And the end result was a huge shakeup at History Colorado. I mean, the director went out, they changed things, they changed the board.
And this was supposed to be a new, fresh introduction to Colorado history with maybe these perspectives that we'd been missing for a long time. What was the museum's defense of sort of screwing this up so bad?
Well, part of it was they'd hired this fabulous company that's supposed to make cutting-edge museums, and they'd paid attention, but they just didn't. And you have to remember that there are people who make museum exhibits, and then there are tribes that are dealing with 140, at the time, 140-year-old tragedy.
Yeah.
And the museum truly added insult to injury by just not listening to them.
So one thing, after the complaints were surfacing from the tribes about the old exhibit, these letters resurfaced that told a more complete story of what happened at Sand Creek. Can you talk about those letters?
Actually, the letters surfaced when Congress was considering whether or not to create this site.
Okay.
In 2000, and that was because Ben Nighthorse Campbell, Native American in our senator, Native American in Congress, was pushing for it. And there were some doubters in the Senate that there should be such a site, that we should ever commemorate a massacre, because you don't see a lot of national massacre sites. Yeah. And so they're doubting it. And meanwhile, the proponents, tribes, historians, they find this cache of letters in a trunk in Evergreen that were written by Silas Sewell, who was in the Army, was with Shivington. He was supposed to, you know, kind of keep an eye on him. He sees what's going on. He says he could not participate in it. He wrote his boss, General Wynkoop, about exactly what he'd seen, how horrible it was. Now, Silas Sewell was assassinated because of his position in 1865, but his letters remained. And in 2000, they show up and they could be introduced into Congress right as they're considering this legislation. It was incredible timing.
And it was just like a documentation that was kind of needed to explain, you know, especially from this conscientious objector point of view, this is exactly what happened.
I'm sure they had found some of the other congressional inquiries in 1864, but to find that, it was living history. These letters
were
incredible.
And these were just in someone's
attic in Evergreen.
Wow. You never know. What do you think that this incident says about how I think uncomfortable a lot of Coloradans are with the uglier parts of our history?
Well, the irony, of course, is that some of them never learned it. So it takes a long time. And in fact, the battlefield, which it was called a battlefield on the Civil War monument at the Capitol, they'd lost track of it. It wasn't until about 30 years ago that people actually found out where it had happened. It was at the time when they were also fighting to have it taken off that monument, listed as a battle of the Civil War, and deal with it as the massacre it was. And if you read my piece, you know, Congress decided it was a massacre in 1864 when there were plenty of other atrocities out there. They investigated Sand Creek and the Army investigated and they agreed it was a massacre.
But in the decades since that,
Then you get the Noble Pioneer line and you have the Civil War monument that was put out, I think, in 1909 and toppled in 2020.
I never knew that about that monument in particular. But next month, History Colorado is opening a new Sand Creek exhibit. Finally, a decade later. Do you know what they're doing differently this time around?
Certainly listening to the descendants, I think they're putting a lot more context in because people forget that the white settlers were not here first. They came to a populated land. And there were many different tribes. One tribe does not speak for another. In fact, there are two Cheyenne tribes. There are two Arapaho tribes because after the Sand Creek Massacre, they fled. The survivors fled north to Wyoming and Montana and east to Oklahoma. So you've got the Oklahoma, Cheyenne, and Arapaho, the Cheyenne of Montana, and the Arapaho of Wyoming.
And sorry, were you saying earlier that the Sand Creek Massacre site was sort of lost to time?
Oh, it was lost. It was lost. They had to have archaeologists and metal. They still go out with metal detectors to find out exactly where it happened. Some of it was on private land, so it had to be bought up. And you still have fights. We almost had an Xcel power line going right over some of this land that is now going to be protected by the Department of the Interior.
Is there anything that you are looking forward to or hoping to see in this new version of the Sand Creek Massacre? I don't want to say a memorial, but the telling of it.
I hope we see that one Native American does not speak for all, that there were many indigenous peoples. And we still have that problem. We've got the naming issue right now with Mount Evans. And one group had the buy-in of one tribe, and they're like, well, we want to name it Mount Blue Sky, which is still one of the names that's up there. But other people don't like that. The Northern Cheyenne, that's a private secret name, so it's not supposed to be on the mountain. So we are not done with the controversies. I think the naming controversies regarding Evans are the next big fight.
Do you think that we're talking differently about Indigenous issues now than we were even just 10 years ago?
Oh, of course we are. I mean, look at the land acknowledgments we are now hearing in front of every Denver City Council meeting, in front of every Colorado official state gathering. There is an acknowledgment that this was not our land originally.
So do you see this as a move towards bigger systemic changes, just the name changes and these acknowledgments?
Well, certainly recognizing history and educating people about history is done with the goal of not repeating that history, unless it happens to be good history. And unfortunately, all too often, it isn't. So I do think it's helping. And History Colorado, if you look at what they've done the last few years, they've greatly expanded their voices, the voices they are hearing. And I think they're doing a good job with that. Although I know you still have to have some entertaining exhibits to get people in. Don't even get me started on the Denver A to Z exhibit. They also are bringing in a lot of new voices, and it's great.
Patty Calhoun, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.